Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for December 29th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs through a collective voice.
Ahead on this weekend edition of Ozarks, a conversation with Justin Minkle, one of the authors of the Mutasia series for young readers. Also, researchers at the University of Arkansas are looking for participants for a research study about stress in parents and adolescents. And Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. There's plenty of suggestions for how to ring in the new year and more.
But first, New York Times political correspondent Jonathan Martin recently made a trip to Arkansas. During his visit, he stopped by the set of KARK's Pure Politics show, Capital View. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas, along with his co-host David Goins, quizzed Martin on the spotlight of the Arkansas U.S. Senate race and those prospects for Hillary Clinton's expected presidential run in 2016.
When we look at 2014 coming up next year, obviously the biggest race in Arkansas deals with this U.S. Senate race with Mark Pryor and Tom Cotton. Last time we talked to you, Cotton had not yet gotten in the race.
Right.
He's now in the race. Is this a race that's being talked about pretty closely in Washington?
I think it's one of the marquee races in the country, perhaps the marquee race in the country, for a lot of reasons, but mostly because Mark Pryor is probably the most sought-after Democratic seat in the country. Now, the Republicans want to take back the Senate next year, obviously, and they see Pryor as the most vulnerable Democrat in the country in the Senate in terms of the incumbents to go after, because Arkansas, as you and your viewers know well, is a conservative-leaning state. It has shifted in recent years toward the Republican Party, but obviously Mark Pryor is the last Democratic holdout in the state's congressional delegation, so he obviously is a top target for Republicans here. But they know it's going to be a tough race because Mark Pryor has a brand name in this state that goes back for well over 40 years because of his father's service as governor and senator. And Mark Pryor has been a very popular figure here in recent years. Didn't even have an opponent in 2008. And here he is, the top target this time around. Shows you how politics has changed in this state and in the country.
And one of the things that I see some chickens being counted before they're hatched in terms of the GOP at times in this race and in some other races in Arkansas, because they do feel like that the state has trended so Republican in recent years. But there's still a lot of time for the sands to shift in this race nationally and at the state level based on a lot of factors that are out there. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Politics changes on a dime. And here we are chatting in December of 13. The race is 11 months away. That's a lifetime in statewide politics. And the fact is, the Republicans are going to try to run a pretty straightforward campaign, tying Mark Pryor to President Obama and to the health care law that President Obama passed. And of course, Mark Pryor will try to run as much more of an Arkansas Democrat, somebody whose roots in the state go back for a long time, and somebody who at times cuts their own path. I mean, to me, the question is that we'll decide the race is this going to be a sort of nationalized, generic race where you've got a Democrat and a Republican? And if that's the case, obviously Cotton's got the advantage. If this is a race that's fought more on local terms, on individual brands, then I think Pryor does stand a chance to win.
I know we like to look at the map and see, you know, how would one party take control of a given chamber as it relates to the Senate and the Republicans? Is there any way they could ever take over the Senate without Arkansas?
It's a great question. It's very hard to see any path for them without beating Pryor. I think you have to look at the South, Arkansas, Louisiana, and North Carolina. Mark Pryor, Mary Landrieu, speaking of household names and states, the Pryors in Arkansas and the Landrieus in Louisiana are two well-known names. And then in North Carolina, you've got Kay Hagan, who's a first-term incumbent. If you talk to Republicans in Washington, they'll tell you, if they're taking back the Senate, they have to start with those three seats in terms of the incumbents. There are some open seats that they want to take elsewhere. But in terms of beating incumbents, you got to have those three.
You ready to talk about 2016 yet?
It's 2013, so we should, right?
Exactly.
It's around the corner.
Lots of talk, obviously, a lot of buzz. Hillary Clinton would be the presumed
front runner. Have you heard some of that,
Roby? I have. I can't remember where I read that. I think it was in the New York Times, maybe in every other publication in America, too. But anyhow, what is the buzz right now in terms of where that sits? Yeah. I mean, is it an inevitability that she gets in this race?
Talk to folks from Washington and New York, and Democrats are really anxious for her to run. Part of that, I think, is because they they want to make history, she should be the first female president. But also, I think there's a sense that 2008 was a tough decision for Democrats. They picked President Obama over her, not because they disliked her necessarily, they just liked him a little better. And the sense that they can sort of right that by nominating her next time around is, I think, a pretty compelling factor among Democratic primary voters. You add the fact that President Obama is having a tough go of it nationally, and there is, I think, a bit of sort of thought and anxiety about what's next. And she obviously is the one they're looking to, and there really is nobody else besides her, unless Vice President Biden wants to run. But nobody in Washington thinks that Joe Biden runs for president if she's running too.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas, along with his Capital View co-host David Goins, speaking with New York Times political correspondent Jonathan Martin. Capital View can be seen Sunday mornings in the Central Arkansas market on KARK Channel 4.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
The Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at aecc.com. And Mitchell Williams Law, providing diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Mitchell Williams Law Firm employs nearly 80 attorneys at offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online, MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
You can hear great jazz right here on KUAF every Friday and Saturday night. Hello, I'm Robert Ginsburg, and my show, Shades of Jazz, can be heard Friday and Saturday nights from 10 till midnight. On Friday night, Daniel Estes steps in at midnight till 1 o'clock with Goodnight Jazz, and on Saturdays, it's Fred Hall taking in the midnight to 1 o'clock hour with Swing Thing. Tune in to KUAF for great jazz.
This is Ozarks at Large. Dr. Ellen Lead Feldner is the director of the Arkansas Interdisciplinary Sciences Laboratory, or ARKIDS, at the University of Arkansas. ARKIDS focuses on understanding what puts kids at risk for anxiety and drug use during adolescence. They're currently focusing on parenting and family factors' effects on those. Parenting in adolescence can be difficult for both parents and kids. And as a parent, if you're dealing with a mental illness or post-traumatic stress disorder, it can be much more difficult. Dr. Liedfeldner is looking for families to participate in a research study to better understand these experiences, which could be heightened during this holiday season.
The holiday season can be very stressful for lots of reasons. And so we do know that when life is more stressful, it's difficult to appropriately and effectively parent, particularly, again, when you're dealing with an adolescent.
So do you focus a lot on post-traumatic stress syndrome, like a stress after a life event?
That's
a traumatic
right.
life event, I guess.
That's right. Right. So we're interested in how parents deal with extreme stress in general. But, right, there are some kinds of events that are very, very stressful or traumatic, and they result in, a set of symptoms that can be really difficult and distressing to live with, and certainly we think impacts that family system.
Even if a parent tries to maybe hide that stress from a child, it still probably trickles down.
It could. I mean, I think there's a lot we don't understand yet. I mean, so, for example, some parents don't even recognize that they have PTSD. And so they're sort of suffering and perhaps not even sure what's going on. One of the things about PTSD is that it just makes it difficult to manage events that are unexpected or distressing. And so, you're sort of tapped out in terms of your ability to manage stress. And so even if you're trying to hide it, it's likely to emerge, and at a different point in a way, right, that might be discernible to kids.
I guess that's what you're trying to understand, is how it does affect kids. But how could it potentially?
Right. So, you know, one piece is genetics, right, that anxiety disorders, including post-traumatic stress disorders, are partially heritable. And that doesn't mean that children are going to develop problems, but they're at a little bit elevated risk, right? And we're beginning to understand that perhaps their brain works a little bit differently. They may respond to stress in a different way than children of parents without PTSD, which, again, does not mean they're going to have problems. But if you add stress to that, so, for example, stress in the family context, that might be enough to sort of turn on some problems. So that's one piece. Another area that we're really focusing on is that the parenting process itself is likely disrupted, right? So again, if you think about parenting an adolescent, one has to be really mindful of which battles to pick and to be consistent and to set boundaries, but not too strict of boundaries. I mean, this is really a nuanced sort of dance. And so that's likely one way that PTSD impacts that relationship and adds stress to that system.
Well, so if some parents, they don't even know that they are dealing with something, how can they come in and help you? How can they ask for help?
Right. Well, you know, the way that we are looking for participants is we're asking for parents who have experienced extreme stress, and then we can discern from there whether or not it rises to the level of PTSD. But it's also really important to know that we are looking for healthy parents, too, so that we can understand, you know, we can compare these families. And so it's not really, we need the community to sort of come out and help us and participate in this research so that we can answer all kinds of questions. So they don't just have to have PTSD or know that they have PTSD, for example.
So the ultimate goal is to provide a place where you can help. Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes. So what we need to do first is understand the nature of this disruption. So I've alluded to, we might think, okay, likely that parent-child relationship is going to have some problems, but there's just almost no data to suggest what that looks like. So, for example, are parents with PTSD, are they more likely to be withdrawn? We don't know. And so we need to sort of start to examine those questions. But the long-term goal is to provide what we might call treatment adjunct. So you go in and you get, well, we have really good treatment for PTSD, and we can think about incorporating into those treatments family systems approaches. So here's some education about what you might expect, and here are some tools that you might be able to use to improve your relationship and understand how PTSD might be affecting it.
Too early to ask what some of those tools may be?
That's a good question. I don't think it's too early necessarily. I mean, it depends, again, on what these relationships look like. So, for example, if one of the things that parents are dealing with is feeling really angry, which is a common feature in PTSD, we could think about stress management. We could talk to them about cues in the environment that are maybe turning on that anger as a part of that PTSD syndrome and how to manage that, right? So take a few minutes to yourself. Here are some conflict resolution strategies. But again, that may not be indicated if that's not what's going on, if you will. But I think once we can discern what the nature of the disruption is, then, right, we do have lots of ways that we can think about intervening.
Well, you look at how the parent is stressed and the parent is going through something. I mean, that's the focus of the study, but what if a child has experienced something? And surely that has an effect on their brothers and sisters and their parents.
Absolutely. That's a really good question. We refer to that as child-driven effects, right? So you're absolutely right that in this relationship, there are two or even more in the system, there are lots of people. And so ultimately, and in fact, we're doing some of this work right now in my lab, we need to understand what the child is bringing to the relationship. So for example, if you're a parent who's struggling with mental illness, you're having trouble dealing with stress, and your child is, you know, temperamentally easy, that's going to be a very different scenario than if your child is dealing, for example, with, you know, extreme anxiety or depression. And we're just beginning to sort of tap into those questions. But you're right. If we're going to have, an intervention that's going to be effective, we need to consider all parties in the system.
What sorts of questions do you ask?
Well, we ask about their feelings and how they're doing. We can get a sense of symptoms. We ask about parenting and parenting approaches. The same with children. We look at how they manage their feelings. And again, at this stage of research development, we're trying to describe the problem, right, or the system. And so these questions are aimed at getting a sense of how is the system working and where are there some problems.
You mentioned earlier that there really isn't much data out there. Why is this something that hasn't really been studied before?
It's hard to study, right? I mean, and again, that is where we find ourselves. We need the help from the community to be able to answer this question. I mean, if you think about it, a parent who's dealing with significant stress, having to get to the lab and participate, that's a tall order, if you will. So they're hard to study, and I would say that there's enough descriptive research to know that these families are disrupted, right? I think we're just now moving into doing something about that.
Why is this something that you personally have chosen to devote your career to?
Right. Well, I'm really interested in anxiety. That's my bread and butter. And I think, honestly, the returning vets, the wars that we have all encountered, and the increasing understanding that PTSD can be extremely debilitating, and then wedding that with my interest in adolescence and the unique parenting challenges of that period, it was sort of an organic process that was influenced by those current events.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
The study takes about 4 hours at the ARKids lab. Parents are paid $20, adolescents $50, because their study is more in-depth. To sign up or for more information, visit www.familieswork.org or call 575-3523. Dr. Ellen Lead Feldner is the director of the Arkansas Interdisciplinary Sciences Laboratory at the University of Arkansas.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Earlier this month, we hosted a special Christmas-themed show at the Fayetteville Public Library. During the event, the library's executive director, David Johnson, spoke to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about what the library has coming up in 2014.
There's an old sage in show business. You never wanted to follow Sinatra. You never want to follow Springsteen. You probably never want to follow Santa. But, David, you get that honor. David Johnson, who is the executive director of the Fayetteville Public Library, ladies and gentlemen. First time that... No, you've had Santa in the building before, right?
Oh, yeah. We've had Santa here many, many times.
All right. We've talked about this being the season of giving, and there's something... I don't know if it's unprecedented in the United States, but not many places have done it. And you've done it with the Fayetteville School District.
Oh, absolutely, Kyle. We were very fortunate to partner with the public school system this year to ensure that every child in the district got a internet-only library card, which will allow them to have access to all of the resources that are online and available at the Fayetteville Public Library.
Every student in the Fayetteville School District.
Yes, every student, absolutely. And we'll be expanding that next year to all of the private schools. And our ultimate goal is that every student in the city of Fayetteville have access to all of our resources online so that they can assist with their education and entertainment and all of those things and not worry about borrowers' fees and all of those kinds of things.
Now, in a few minutes, Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Media, Northwest Arkansas Newspapers, is going to give us a list of what we should do in 2014. I want to talk to you about 2014 for just a bit because you've got a big event in the spring of 2014.
We do. April 11th, we'll have Maya Angelou here speaking and singing and reading for us. April 11th is going to be a historic evening for the Fayetteville Public Library and for the Fayetteville community. We're very excited.
And stay tuned.
Stay tuned. There's another prominent author that could be coming into town the following month. I can't reveal a name yet, but she's going to be having a film of one of her books coming out at about the same time. It's a book that's been on the New York Times bestseller list for ages, but we're very excited about this opportunity that sort of fell into our lap just today.
And that's all we can tell you right now. All right.
Yeah, that's all I can say. Gone Girl, that's all I can...
Okay. There you go. David, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That was Fayetteville Public Library Executive Director David Johnson speaking to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums during a special Christmas show at the library earlier this month. For more on what's happening at the library in 2014, you can visit faylib.org.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life.
Oh my God.
One thing I really like in a radio story.
What's back there?
Nothing. It looks empty.
No, there's someone living back there.
He's a mystery.
I'm not going back there.
There's somebody's hair. There's a head in there.
There's a shrunken head right there.
Mysteries explained each week. This American Life.
It's Santa Claus. Resident Evil?
Listen to This American Life Sundays at 10 a.m. on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Woohoo! We survived.
Christmas is in the rearview mirror. New Year's is approaching.
Next.
We haven't quite walked away from 2013, though, because we have to finish our top 10 countdown.
Yes, this started last week on Ozarks, and you gave us stories 10, 9, 8, 7, and 6 that you and your staff considered at What's Up the biggest entertainment type stories in Northwest Arkansas for 2013. So now we're going to hit the top five.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Let's go.
Number 5 is the Marshalls Museum breaking ground in Fort Smith.
Yes.
And the Amazium picking a location and actually planning to come into existence in Bentonville.
So those are together.
Yes.
And the Marshalls Museum still has some work to do, and they know it. And the Amazium had this year picked up a nice financial gift as well. So hopefully not too many years from now, that'll be maybe near the top of the list.
Really looking forward to both of those. Number 4 is the Amp moving to Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one.
It is a big one. Number 3 is...
And, I'm sorry. The hope is that the first concert is sometime in the first half of 2014, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the hope if the weather goes right and the construction goes on. Yeah,
I think so. The last I heard, it's on track. Yeah.
All right.
Number 3 is the reopening of the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum.
Yes.
Which happened in January of 2013.
In a sleek, new-to-them building that used to be a bank.
Renovated, mm-hmm. Yes.
And
it's
that
nice.
Art Deco feel. Mm-hmm. Really nice. Really nice.
Number 2 is Crystal Bridges hitting its millionth visitor.
Mm-hmm.
And the success of the Rockwell exhibition.
Huge success.
And number 1 is the Walton Arts Center vote to revitalize.
So that was by the electorate in Fayetteville, part of a 3-plank city plan that included renovation for Walton Arts Center.
And that's probably going to be the biggest story moving forward. So we'll see.
So you think, you would say, if you were an odds maker, and you are not, you would say that has a high chance of being in the top 5 again next year.
I believe it does.
When the renovations are complete.
Exactly.
Right. Well, it's going to take,
a couple
more
of
than
years.
A year. Yeah.
But
they're going to work
on
it this summer, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it will take longer than that.
Right. Okay.
Yes. Okay.
But it's been a very exciting arts year.
It has. It has. And it's amazing to think about the dramatic difference in the arts in 2013 as opposed to, say, 1993, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Huge
well,
difference.
You remember the hole on Dixon Street.
Oh, my gosh. You could not go to a party in Fayetteville, at least if not Northwest Arkansas, and not have someone ask you how you felt about that and which side you were on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad we moved past that and we found common
have
ground.
Happiness.
Yes.
And we also have New Year's Eve parties.
Some of us do. Some of us take it easy on New Year's Eve.
And I plan to take it easy this year. But there's some things going on.
All right.
Pine Mountain Theater in Eureka Springs is hosting a New Year's Eve party, including music and Hop and John served during intermission.
Love Hop and John. Now, that is a more or less a tradition with my family.
Black Eyed Peas?
You bet.
Mm-hmm.
Starts at 8 o'clock on New Year's Eve, and tickets are $24.95. That's 253-9156 if you need it. There is a singin' at Hickory Grove Baptist Church near Clifty.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have a 7 p.m. New Year's Eve gospel sing and refreshments at 10. And it's free.
That's right on the highway, right? Right on 45.
Teamworks has a New Year's Eve event with proceeds benefiting the Northwest Arkansas Miracle League and Teamworks. It's to help children with special needs. And that starts at 7:30 at Pratt Place Barn in Fayetteville. Tickets are $50.
Cool.
21C has a special, didn't know how to say this in New Orleans. I don't know how to say it now.
Okay.
You sit down. The chef brings you food.
Okay.
And
to your table.
Yes. And that starts at 5:30 or at 8 on New Year's Eve.
Two seatings. Mm-hmm.
Last Night Fayetteville.
Oh, yes.
Includes a giant puppet parade and all that fun on the Fayetteville Square. Mm-hmm. Tim and Jeff's New Year's Eve Bash.
Yes.
You might know somebody who's involved in that. Since Ultra Suede is playing.
Yes.
A champagne toast at midnight and Ultra Suede and party favors and all this happens at the Holiday Inn in Springdale.
Mm-hmm.
The Fort Smith Mayor's Countdown to 2014, a fun for all ages non-alcoholic festival that starts at 8 o'clock at the Fort Smith Convention Center, and a New Year's Eve party at the Elks with food and drinks and entertainment with the Peterson Brothers at the Elks Lodge in Fort Smith.
Okay.
The Bayou in Rogers has Trick Bag, a Delta Band.
Oh, okay.
And New 365, which is the party of the year at Crystal Bridges.
Oh, yeah.
With Leah and the Mojo Doctors and DJ Havoc and all kinds of fun. And that's $85. And you can find out more about all of these by checking What's Up.
All right. Are you the type of person that makes resolutions?
Yes.
Okay. Are you, Christina?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
Do you have one?
Well, I know work-related, I said that I wanted to do more music. Antoinette and Kyle do a lot of the music
stories,
and I want to. I'd like to do a few more of those.
Okay, what's yours?
Calm down. Take a deep breath.
How long have I known you?
A while.
Good luck with that.
Thank you. Well, wait, you asked that. What, do you have one?
I do have one.
Do you want to share? You don't have to.
No, I'm going to try to do a better job of standing up for myself without just doing nice things that I don't want to do.
Okay, we're going to work on that one as well.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Becca.
Happy New Year, y'all.
Happy New Year. Becca Martin Brown is Features Editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. There are some odd characters inhabiting Mutasia. One animal, for example, is part cow, part possum. Another is a combination of a mosquito and a wasp. The creatures are included in stories that help young readers better understand their world. Each story in the series is written by someone who has been designated a Teacher of the Year in their state. The second book in the series is Clubhouse Clash, and it's written by Justin Minkle. Justin, an elementary school teacher in the Springdale School District, was named Arkansas's Teacher of the Year in 2007. He says his book about a misunderstanding that escalates into a full conflict was inspired, in part, by watching his students. He recently stopped by the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums.
So the world and the characters were created by other people, other than me, some really brilliant artists that kind of brought everything to life visually. And what I love about it is that it's basically this island where there are no adults. It's sort of this society of children. And in a way, it sort of flips Lord of the Flies because, you know, there's no adults, but instead of terrible things happening, they all get along just fine, you know. But the characters, even though they're children, the actual characters are animals, and they're sort of hybrid animals. So, you know, like they've got these stuffed animals I brought in with me today, and the main character is fused with a cow and a possum, and there's another character that's like a cheetah and an elephant, and, you know, sort of the heroine of this story is a gazelle mixed with a bird, like with a duck. So, and I think that's why kids are so into it and why, you know, like my son Aiden, who's two, loves the stuffed animals so much, is there's sort of been a saturation of characters who are animals, like Winnie the Pooh, Kung Fu Panda. But at the same time, this is kind of different from something like Dr. Seuss, where who knows what those things are, because kids recognize the pieces of a possum or the trunk of an elephant or whatever. You know, Aiden said, oh, I love his trunk. Look at his trunk. But they're strange. You know, they're hybrid animals. So.
And they live in this island. It's, as the story goes, it has not been found by humans. But there are different places. So, I mean, you can see touches of J.R. Tolkien in this, mm-hmm. because here's where the swamplands are and here's who lives there. And so there's a there's a map available.
Yeah, definitely. And what I love about the setting of this particular book is it was in a part of the island called Tree Village. And as soon as I read about it, I was like, okay, I'm in. You know, and like you said about Tolkien, it reminded me of Lorien, you know, sort of these enormous trees. You know, I lived in the Bay Area for a while, so it reminded me of the Redwoods. Mm-hmm. And I just love it because there's not a lot of urban influence. You know, there's not a lot of technology. The kids, the animals are really resourceful. You know, they sort of make their own things. And it's basically the middle of a forest.
So how did you connect with the people who created this land to write a story for them?
I really feel like I lucked out. It was a teacher of the year who's the 2007 Illinois Teacher of the Year, and his vision for this was that he'd find writers who were also teachers of the year.
And which you were for Arkansas.
Yeah, for Arkansas. And so the idea is that then, you know, the books are good adventure stories on their own. They stand alone, but he'd also have these teachers go through and create lesson plans that go with them. So if a teacher wanted to do it as a read-aloud with a little guided reading group in class, there's all these lessons that kind of build on the themes or the adventure in the book. So, you know, this the previous book was written by the Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. This is like kind of one out of these 10 books that will be coming out. The third book will be, you know, this Illinois Teacher of the Year, and then I did the second one.
Now, I don't want to give too much away, but what happens in this book is a mean song is written by one animal about another, and it escalates. Right? It's called Clubhouse Clash, so things start happening.
Exactly, yeah. And I feel like there were influences from books I read as a kid. Like, I always loved the Butter Battle book, you know, which is about the Cold War, but it's basically this escalation of increasingly giant weapons. And so a similar thing happens here where, you know, you're exactly right. There's a song that is sort of misheard, sort of like if you ever played that game Telephone, mm-hmm. where you start with a normal sentence and it ends up getting so garbled. So a friend overhears that song and thinks it's mean and relays it to this kid in the book who gets really kind of upset and decides that she's after him, and it leads to this escalating clash of the clubhouses. The idea actually came from my third grader's conflicts at recess. I mean, that's what it came out of. And so what I noticed is there was a real gender divide for second and third graders. So with the boys, it was usually very straightforward. You know, Carlos kicked me when we were playing soccer. I got mad, so I punched him in the head. But now we're fine. You know, it's very physical, very violent, and it's over right away.
Right.
For the girls, it was this really elaborate kind of set of miscommunications. So I'd have a student come up a lot of times just in tears and say, Daniela doesn't want to be my friend anymore. And my question was always, you know, did you hear her say that? Well, no, but Maria's cousin heard that when she was at her house last week, then Anna told her that her friend overheard, you know, and so it's
right.
This chain of miscommunication. And a lot of times once she goes up to that girl, it's not what the girl said at all.
I don't mean to get away from the book for a minute, but is that something that happens when you're a teacher? Like you, because those of us who don't have children or aren't in the schools, we think you're teaching reading or math or whatever. But do you hear their problems a lot? Their personal?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think a lot of it, too, is, you know, what you realize pretty quickly is that if you can address those things, what are really going on with the kids, it actually saves you so much time to really teach the academic stuff. So, you know, my wife Karen and I were teaching in New York, and we realized that even though we had all these systems in place, the kids had conflicts that really distracted them. And recess and lunch would just ruin a child. You know, they'd come back angry, and it was just over for the day. So we developed this idea that's actually in the book of a peace talk that's really straightforward, where the kids go off on their own. There's no adults involved, but we teach the process up front. They basically say, you know, when you did this, I felt this way. I felt angry. You know, when you talked about how my drawing looked silly and you laughed, it made me feel embarrassed. You know, next time I want you to just tell me that quietly, not in front of the class. So there's just, you know, here's how I felt. Here's what I want you to change. The other child says it, and then they shake hands if they want, and it's done. And it was amazingly effective, even though it was so simple. And so that's kind of the resolution in here, is that idea of a peace talk.
When you're writing a book like this, I mean, this is aimed for young readers. Do you hope that that sinks in? I mean, as a writer, you never know what is taken away. But is that kind of the hope, that maybe there will be some of that done in real life?
Definitely. And I think that's kind of the vision for these books, is that they don't want them to be preachy. They don't want there to be a lesson. They're not fables, you know, where there's this really heavy-handed moral at the end. But at the same time, the idea is, you know, they're written not just for parents who want to share them with their kids, but teachers who might want to use them in the class. And so for this one, some of the lesson plans that come out of it deal with those themes of conflict, not just between two kids, but between nations. And a lot of the language is the same. A lot of the principles are the same. So if you look in this book, you know, there's the idea of innocent bystanders, for example. When we get into this clash of the clubhouses, most of the people who get hurt are not the ones actually involved in the conflict. They're all the neighbors who end up getting smashed by mistake, sort of collateral damage, you know. And then just the idea of escalation, that it can start with a miscommunication. Pretty soon it leads to kind of a physical conflict, and it gets out of hand really quickly. So, yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot of implications for kids, but also when they look at history and kind of the history of war with people.
How does it work that you're writing scenes and dialogue and attitudes of characters that somebody else has invented? Was there back and forth like, wait a second, this character wouldn't do that or might do it in a different way?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time looking through just the images that had been created by the artists, and then there's sort of these profiles, you know, of what the characters are like. So one of my favorites is sort of the heroine, Zabetta, and she's a little bit like Katniss Everdeen in the Hunger Games books. You know, she's very resourceful. She's very fierce. She's a loyal friend, but you really don't want to mess with her. You know, she kind of creates her own weapons, you know, her own tools. And so I read a lot of that sort of background, and then it helped me, too, that there'd already been one book written in the series, so I could sort of look at, you know, not only kind of their personality, but everything down to the way they talk and sort of, you know, their demeanor. So in some ways, I think it helped me to have that context. It wasn't sitting down from scratch the way it is with these other novels I'm trying to get published where I created everything and it took years. There was already a map. There were already characters there.
All right, Justin Minkle, author of Clubhouse Clash. Do you mind reading a bit from this?
Sure.
And what's happening here?
So I'll pick up in the middle where basically the conflict has gotten out of hand. There's two warring clubhouses. One is these two female characters, Zabetta, who I just mentioned, and sort of her sidekick. The other is Figley, who's this really sweet, kind of emotional male character, and he's got his own sidekick. And so they're kind of escalating the conflict when we come here at the top of these giant trees in Tree Village. Smash. Oh, and one thing I should tell you. These creatures who are hybrids, some of them already existed, but we could also create our own. So one of the creatures I invented in here is called a waspido. So it's basically a combination of a wasp and a mosquito. So something you would not want to mess with. They have the proboscis to sting you on the front. They've also got the stinger on the end. So one of the weapons that the kids end up using in here are these waspido hives. So it's sort of like a hornet's nest, but worse.
Before you go, what dark place in your brain came up with a cross between a wasp and a mosquito?
You know, I have no idea. I was just reading so many of these hybrid creatures in here. I just thought it would be a terrible thing. I love the name. It sort of sounds like torpedo, you know.
And it sounds like something you'd find in the Ozarks.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, every year I see bugs I've never seen before, despite living here since third grade. So here it is. Smash. A waspido hive struck a house just below Figley's hut. Figley's neighbor, a little kid with floppy ears and a beak, ran out onto his porch. He howled in pain as he flapped his big ears at the cloud of waspidos hovering above him. Figley and Waddy ran to load the first arrow into their crossbow. Fire! Waddy yelled. They pulled the trigger, and the huge arrow flew into the air. The arrow missed Zabetta's hut, but it smashed into the next tree over. The gourd at the arrow's tip shattered against a tree, slopping swamp slime into the hammock that belonged to Zabetta's neighbor, an amphibious marsupial. The marsupial hopped out of her hammock and scooped the slime out of her pouch, shaking her fist at the sky. A kind of madness took hold of Figley and Waddy then. They loaded each arrow as fast as they could, breathing hard. Figley's heart pounded in his chest, and the blood beat in his ears like thunder. Crashes, smashes, howls, yowls, whacks, and thwacks cracked the peaceful night. There were some near misses. Figley leapt off the porch just before a rotten stenchelope would have thumped him on the head, and Rumbler ducked an arrow that almost crushed her fuzzy belly. But most of the arrows and ammo missed their targets, creating havoc in Tree Village. Neighbors had fled their homes for the ground below, abandoning their huts as huge arrows flew through their windows and stenchelopes splattered their doors. Waddy and Figley loaded their last arrow into the crossbow and then stopped. An eerie silence had fallen. They must be out of ammo for their catapult, Waddy squealed. He rubbed his hands together, grinning a crazy grin. We won the war. Figley looked around at the broken branches and smashed huts. He listened to the wails and sobs from the frightened neighbors gathered below. Just an hour ago, this had been their peaceful neighborhood. If this is what it feels like to win, he said softly, I'd hate to lose.
Okay, so we hear that. Should we, you know, it's easy to extrapolate that there's something bigger you're talking about here.
Yeah, and again, I mean, that's what I think when you look at conflict resolution with kids, you know, not only does it sort of help them resolve their conflicts, but it helps them think through human conflict, you know, not only the problem, but also the solution, you know, that you get to later. And I think, again, you know, that idea of innocent bystanders. I mean, if you look at something, you know, contemporary like Syria, a lot of times the people that get hurt the most are not the ones who are actually firing the weapons. It's all those innocent people who really just want to go about their lives, you know, the innocent bystanders.
We defined a waspido, a stenchelope?
Stenchelope is basically like a cantaloupe, except with a horrible, swampy smell.
Is it fun to come up with stuff like this?
It's great. Yeah, it's great. That's what I think kids will like so much about the world. It's just it's so colorful. It's so vivid. It reminds me of a rainforest in terms of just the diversity of plant life and animal life. There's something here called snapping myrtle that's sort of like a crepe myrtle combined with a snapping turtle where it's a plant sort of like a Venus flytrap, but this beak pops out, you know? So it's just this kind of crazy world. And there's a lot of, you know, great art that's been done by the artists involved. You know, there's all these stuffed animals. They actually have a couple little animated shorts they're coming out with now. So it's just a fun, colorful world.
What do you think is the effect of making it an adult-free world? I mean, we're talking not humans, but animals. But having them being somewhat juvenile, do you think young readers get something from that?
Yeah, I think in some ways it's every kid's fantasy to have a world without adults. I mean, you know, the reality might be harder than they think. But, you know, this other book that I wrote that I'm working on getting published now, the premise is in some ways similar to Harry Potter, that there's this school where you learn these, you know, magical abilities. But the difference is it's a school run by children. And when I ask my students, you know, what would you think about a school run by kids? No adults, no teacher, no principal. You know, their eyes light up and they get really excited. I also talked, you know, I went down to one of the Arkansas Society of Children Book Writers and Illustrators conferences, and they had an agent there, and she said the biggest problem she sees with manuscripts that come to her are that adults solve the problems. And she said, you know, it's fine to have adults in there, like Dumbledore is in Harry Potter, but ultimately it's Harry and Ron and Hermione that are solving the problems.
I had never thought about that, but some of the books that I enjoyed so much as a young reader, the Hardy Boys and things like that, it was the younger people who were eventually solving. They might have aid from adults.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Boxcar Children for the same reason. I mean, it's these kids kind of seeing, can they make it on their own, you know, without all the rules of adults.
You're a writer. You're also someone who you preach the value of reading at a very young age. You've seen how reading makes students better, right?
Definitely. Yeah, one of the projects I worked on lately was this home library project called the 1,000 Books Project, where basically I realized my students who are at Jones Elementary in Springdale, mostly lower income, mostly English learners, a lot of them had 3 books at home or 7 books. Then I looked at my daughter, who then was 2, who had, you know, these 3 shelves filled, and I just realized it's such an obvious thing. But having those books in your life, like you just talked about with the Hardy Boys, it has a tremendous influence. You know, so we did this project where the kids built up a home library of 40 books, and I just saw a tremendous change, not just as readers in terms of ability, but as people, as human beings.
Someone, I don't know if it was you, termed coined the term book gap, that there are kids who have a lot of books in their lives and some children who don't.
Yeah, and the research I read was pretty staggering. I mean, they talked about, you know, even in middle-class families, it was a lot lower than I would have thought, about 12 books to a kid, and they talked about some inner-city neighborhoods being crazy. I mean, it was like 300 children for one age-appropriate book. And so I think it's something that schools just don't think about. You know, and so that's kind of the, like, when I'm writing it, I just enjoy it. I get into the story. I feel like sometimes the characters do things I didn't intend at some point. You know, you write it and you're like, wow, I didn't see that coming until I was in the middle of writing. But at the same time, when you're done, I mean, that's part of the hope, is that these kids will experience these books. You know, I mean, I grew up in Stone County, Arkansas, where there was a library. It wasn't incredible, but my dad would always mail me these books when he had to leave for the work, you know, in other states. And so I'd run down, you know, this gravel road and open it, and there'd be, you know, the Great Brain book or, you know, Children of the Dragon, some fantasy book. And it's just incredibly exciting.
So where can people find this book?
Nightbird Books. Lisa Sharp, who's wonderful and always supports local authors, has, you know, agreed to order some books, and she'll keep it in stock there. You know, by the time this airs, I will have just done a little signing with some other local authors, and she has those sort of local author extravaganzas every once in a while. And there's also a website, mutasia.com. It's just mutasia.com.
So that's how it's pronounced. I had a reader's vocabulary in that, mutasia.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, for the mutation.
Exactly.
I gotcha. Yeah. Well, who are your friends that you brought with you?
So I've got 3 of the characters here. They have these little stuffed animals. Zabetta, you know, who's probably my favorite.
And she, you made her the heroine of your book.
Exactly, yeah. And she is, you know, part gazelle, part duck, like her duck legs here. Then Figley is sort of the hero of a lot of the books, or sort of the protagonist. He's, you know, part possum and part cow. And then Chadwick is, you know, fairly scientific. He's got this long sort of elephant trunk, but he's more of sort of a cheetah.
I like it. And the other book you mentioned that you're working on, or have you completed it?
Yeah, I've completed it, and right now I'm sending it out to agents and publishers. It's, you know, for kids in the middle grades. It's a little bit older than these. This book is really, you know, for kids to read on their own, maybe first, second, third graders, up to fifth graders who get excited about, you know, the Clash of the Clubhouses. And then as a read aloud for kids as young as my daughter, who's 5.
Do you remember a couple of books that when you were very young, some of the first books you read that really got you hooked on reading?
Definitely. I mean, my mom read me The Hobbit when I was really little, and it was too hard for me. And something about that idea of Bilbo Baggins just loving home so much, but also, you know, loving the adventures he had, really stuck. I've read that one probably 20 times. Like when I went to West Africa, wow. I read it on the plane. About any time I take this big trip, you know. And then just, you know, I was always into fantasy books as a kid.
All right. Justin, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Kyle.
Justin Minkle is the author of the new book, Clubhouse Clash, that is part of the Mutasia series for young readers. He is an elementary school teacher in Springdale and was named the Arkansas Teacher of the Year in 2007. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this month.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Anthony Grajeda.
200 years ago this weekend, Buffalo, New York was being burned to the ground by the British.
Oh.
It was in the War of 1812. Now, granted, 200 years ago it was 1813.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, well, the war went for a while.
Okay.
Sure.
So I'm using the burning of Buffalo. Of course, it came back, right, as a great city, the second most populated city in the state of New York. I'm using the burning of Buffalo as inspiration for this morning's montage. Everything you're about to hear is either connected to Buffalo or connected to the War of 1812. This is one of the more obscure montages.
I'm
going to
say I'm not going to get any of this.
Oh, no, 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 because some of these you'll recognize.
Mm.
So it's like a two-planked quiz this morning. Can you identify it? And then what is the connection to Buffalo?
What about the animal buffalo?
Yeah.
There is no connection.
Aww,
to the animal. No,
I would have done that.
Okay.
Well, that would have been clever, but I didn't do that.
Take me now, baby, here as I am. Pull me close and try and understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed.
Knock the cover off the ball.
It's Marilyn Monroe skyrocketing to new dramatic heights. When a man took her loveliness in his arms, he took his life in his hands. Joseph Cotten, helpless in her siren spell. Jean Peters, caught in the destructive whirlpool of another's deceit.
And parading around, showing herself off in that dress, cut down so low in front you could see her kneecaps.
The loathing the anarchists have for him. They know his life will always be at risk. The previous year, an enterprising US Secret Service agent had unearthed what amounted to an anarchist hit list.
that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow.
Hello, Kitty.
Hello. Ah, this looks like a mass meeting.
Yeah, you look just fine.
Oh, yeah, just look nice, rested. Well, thank you. I don't mean to interrupt.
We took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago.
If you'd like to see a list of all of the clips that are in the montage and each of the clips' connection to Buffalo, you can go online to OzarksAtLarge.com.
Think about the birth of an idea and all the possibilities it presents.
The big idea here.
Whatever brilliant ideas
to
you
believe
have
in
or
the true
hear,
nature of reality
is the
beckons.
Gift of the human imagination.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for an audio journey through the big ideas of our time. Ideas that will change your view of the world on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour coming up today at noon here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
And let's see. We have the Week of Favorites coming up beginning tomorrow on Ozarks at Large.
We do. It's become a bit of a tradition here at Ozarks at Large. At the end of the year, we get together, the whole staff, to reflect on the year past and talk about some of our favorite stories.
It's always really interesting to see what my coworkers choose as some of the favorite stories that they've worked on. And it's fun to pick my own as well.
What's always interesting is the stuff that you've forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we do so many stories so quickly, and you're always thinking about the next thing, that when you get to the end of the year and you ask what my favorites are, I always look at you and like, I don't remember what I've done.
Well, it's funny you bring up forgetting, because mm-hmm. I was telling Christina a few minutes ago when I was working on a show earlier this week, the show mm-hmm. that aired Friday, and I was getting some really, to me, really old pieces of Ozarks at Large. I had forgotten, and how do you forget this? I had forgotten that Bill Clinton and I stood on a nearly deserted Garrison Avenue and talked about whether he was going to run for president or not. How do you forget that?
How do you forget that?
I don't know, but then I was listening, and then, of course, it all comes back to you.
Well, it might be one of those things that it's, I mean, in retrospect, it's much bigger than it was at the time.
Right, because he was governor, and
yeah,
it wasn't
right.
that unusual.
That's not that unusual.
That you would, because mm-hmm. he was up here a lot.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Lots of fun.
And the next step is to maybe run for president, I guess. I don't know.
And he did. It wasn't yeah. that long after mm-hmm. that he announced.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's fun.
Now, I will tell you that beginning in April, we're going to start the countdown to the 25th anniversary.
Why beginning in April?
Well, that will be the actual 25th year that I've hosted Ozarks at Large.
So April is the 25th?
No, well,
sorry.
It will be the 25th year. So, like, you know, the first year you do something, like the January through December,
mm-hmm.
it's not your first year anniversary, but it's the first year you've
done
it.
Oh, okay.
So anyway,
I'm with you.
We're going to do something a little bit each month beginning in April, just reflecting back on some of the stuff.
And then April 2015 will be the...
March 2015.
Okay.
Will be the 25th
anniversary. Will be the big... Okay.
I don't know what we're going to do. I have no idea.
I think I understand.
I'm sorry.
You just tell me when the party is,
okay.
and I will be
All
there.
Right. All right. thank you, Antoinette, for coming in on Sunday.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, guys.
You bet. And the favorites begin tomorrow at noon, and we'll run all through the week. And we'll be all together next Sunday as well.
Mm-hmm. We will. For our favorite music.
Of the last 6 months.
Yes.
Okay. Take a deep breath. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks so much for listening.
Have a good Sunday.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville.